kids. It's time to get some SML podcast all up in that.
What's up, everyone? This is the SML Podcast. I am your host, Joe. Joining as usual, Cole. Cole, how are you doing today?
I'm awful. It's rainy and I don't feel good.
Nice.
You weren't expecting that, were you?
No, I wasn't. Normally, I just get the, I'm alive.
No, I feel like shit today. Honesty is the best policy, Joe.
Very true. Very true.
We're not alone, though.
No, we aren't.
Would you like to introduce our guest?
Ryan Miller of Reptoid Games, how are you doing today?
Hi, I'm doing good today.
How's Toronto?
Toronto's busy. I caught the fifth streetcar that stopped at my stop because the first four were full.
Wow, that's a lot of people.
yeah. But it's okay, I made it.
You did. You made it. You're on time. You're happy. You're in good spirits. Everyone else is just tired and dragging ass, and you're pulling us up out of the gutter.
My pleasure.
I'm like processing the concept that there are more people in those streetcars than there are in my town. That's terrible.
Yeah, Cole lives kind of in the middle of nowhere. So there's, 40-some people in your town, you said?
42.
Ooh, yeah, no, the streetcars definitely have more than that.
I think I've told the story on the show before, but when I was pregnant with number 3, our Wikipedia page for the town said our population was 41. And then like 3 or 4 days after she was born, it was edited and said 42.
So in a town of 42 people, do you know who edits the Wikipedia page for it?
I don't. I have don't know who it really is.
That's knowable information compared to larger cities.
We have like a little building here in town, and there's a whole genealogical society, and people really get wrapped up in the historical side of this area. So I wouldn't be surprised if it's not somebody from down at the genealogical society. It's just I'm antisocial and I don't give a fuck about anybody. I'm not from here. I was imported, so I don't care.
I'm more impressed that your town of 40 people has a genealogical society. I didn't expect that.
It's where our bank used to be. We used to have a bank. We had a bank for the longest ass time. And then about 3 or 4 years ago, they closed our bank down, and rather than tear down the building, they gave it to the genealogical society from the bigger town next to us. And so they have like a little branch and you can go down here and like request public records and stuff like that and find out your family history. Except mine, because I'm not from here. They don't care.
Oh, God.
But the rest of them, it's really cool. Like the history of this area. It's just really weird.
How does every show devolve into talking about your area?
I live in a weird place. I can't help it.
What's the name of the city or the township?
It's called Blaine now, but it used to, I have this old book with like all the old names and stuff. The original name of this place was Old Mouth of the Hood Town.
What the hell?
Seriously.
Old Mouth of the Hood Town.
That's what the place was originally called. Yeah.
That's a pretty good name.
It's just a weird little town, man.
See, that's new even for me. I haven't heard that one before.
Yeah, I'll have to go get my book and like take a picture of it. But it describes like, it's very biblical in how it does it. Like, oh, this family from this area settled here and beget this many children. And you're like, what?
Beget.
You know? And yeah, it's very technical for a bunch of hillbillies.
Good Lord.
Sorry, I derailed this. You want to talk about your game?
I'd love to. I'm like checking your webpage. I'm like, this is a video gaming podcast. I'm pretty sure it's like my small town knowledge is okay, but I'm worried I might not have enough to contribute.
Oh no, this is all small town discussion. We don't know what video games are.
It's perfectly okay to come on the show and just make fun of how I talk and where I live.
Hey, yeah. I'm a Canadian, so I'm not gonna throw stones. I'm sure my accent's pretty thick.
It's not. It sounds fine, but you know, when you sound like me, everybody sounds fine.
There you go.
Good, yeah, to have very fun. Very true. Anyway, you're here to talk about your game Fossil Hunters, correct?
Correct, yeah.
We should get on the subject that we're here to talk about.
Right, so Fossil Hunters, yeah. So my company, Reptoid Games, which we started about 3 years ago, this is our kind of flagship game, our first big game launch. It's a kind of casual action-adventure game about digging for fossils and connecting those fossils together to create your own dinosaur skeletons. So we just launched on Xbox and PS4. We launched on Nintendo Switch a few months ago, and Steam before that.
Nice. Good to hit all the platforms.
Yeah, it's a pretty wild ride to just have that many launches all at once as well. It's kind of staggered throughout the year. Yeah, it's very exciting. It's definitely a childhood dream come true to get on all those consoles. So, you know, I've worked for other companies before that have shipped games, you know, lots of places, but it's different when it's yours.
Very true.
How did you come up with the idea of letting people create their own dinosaur skeletons from the fossils?
See, so I wish I could connect this to me being a really big fan of Jurassic Park and paleontology as a kid. But the answer is that we iterated our way towards it. So we kind of just wandered our way into fossils. Originally, when we set out, it's actually when we first started the company, my partner Simon and I had worked together in the animation industry, but then we hadn't worked together for several years, and we didn't work on games together, but we did want to start a company. So to get used to working together, we did 4 games in 1 month.
Oh, wow.
Like a game jam. I'm not sure if you've heard of game jams before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we did a bunch of 1 week or less games that we built. And one of those games was called Minotaur.
Minotaur.
Minotaurs in a mine. And it's just really quick, kind of drop in, drop out, deathmatch kind of thing. So we built that game. It was pretty fun. And we just kind of kept building on it. So it started out as, you know, you're a Minotaur, you've got, you know, 2 attacks or something, and you're trying to kill the other guy. And there's all these kind of dirt blocks that you can hit to, you know, get near the other person. And when you die, you respawn on a dirt block that you can kind of slam on the other player with. So there's a lot of digging in it, but it was mostly a kind of deathmatch game. We were playing a lot of Samurai Gun and Towerfall and Nidhogg at the time. So we were really into that kind of like local multiplayer stuff. So continuing to play that, build on that game, we just started kind of adding more and more. So we said, okay, what if you don't play as Minotaurs, you play as humans, and you're digging through these blocks, and if you find 2 Minotaur horns, then you can connect them together, then you transform into the Minotaur. So tried that out. It was okay. Kind of missing something. We added this thing where you can collect gold in the dirt. You can collect other bones in the dirt, and then maybe everyone's working together. There's this big drill machine that'll take you to the next level, and you can collect fossils and put it in the drill machine, and it'll crunch it into fossil fuel and let you go into the next level. And it was getting to pretty classic, you know, game jam scope creep territory, or for just throwing every idea and building it and seeing how it turns out. So it's getting pretty wild there and pretty unfocused. So at one point we had poured a whole bunch of content into the game, a whole bunch of mechanics that weren't really working. So we sat down, we took a really hard look at it, and we said, what is actually working in this? Like, if we're making another, you know, top-down, people can hit each other, you can dig, whatever kind of game, like, that's been done before. So what's a unique kind of thing that we can lean into? And we're like, well, we got these fossils that you can drag around. What if we, like, connected them to each other? We're like, okay, interesting. Connect fossils to each other? I guess we could do that. You think people want to build skeletons? We're like, well, let's try it out. So we built up the skeleton stuff a little bit more, and we're like, oh, this is cool. We can build some like really big things or some really small things. You can get silly and connect a head to a head or a tail to a tail. so that's when we knew that we were really onto something. So then evaluating a lot of other stuff that was going on, we're like, okay, let's throw out the combat. Let's throw out the Minotaur. Let's throw out this. And then we kind of had our marching orders from then. We for saying, this is a game about building fossils or building skeletons. So that was a really good kind of compass throughout development, because we eventually applied for funding and managed to build it, not just the two of us, but with our team. At any time we had kind of doubted any kind of design decision or weren't sure about where the game was going, we just reminded ourselves, like, this is a game about building skeletons. It's heavy on the exploration. Combat isn't a part of the game, really. And that always kind of led us the right way.
And you got through all of this in a week span during the game jam, or was it longer than that?
I should have clarified that. So week span was that.
This was all still the initial week.
No, this was, it was pretty quick. This was over the course of about 3 months.
Wow.
That's so impressive.
Week span. Yeah, the 1 week span was the Minotaur deathmatch thing, which I've been looking for an excuse to put up somewhere for people to play, because it's still fully functional in its own little form. But no, the kind of iterating on it happened a little bit later, a couple months later. We spent about 2 or 3 months developing that.
And you said you started with two people. How big did the team grow?
We grew up to 5 people during production. That's the core team, not including, we had an awesome sound guy on board. So he was external. We had some QA people that were external. So we had a couple external people that were kind of part-timing for us. But the core team in-house, because we're really big on developing a studio, not just developing a game. Mm-hmm. So our core team is 5.
And what is your role exactly?
So my role is, officially it's technical director. So what that means in this time, because that job gets kind of morphed a lot into whatever the particular company needs or the project needs.
Yeah, it kind of sounds like a catch-all type of position.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's a bit of a cop-out. So I was the lead programmer, basically. We had one other programmer that we brought on for not quite the whole project, but I was the lead programmer, so all the architecture of the game and all the core systems, for the most part, I built. But because my background is not just in programming, it's actually in animation, I did a fair bit of the models, the textures, and the rigging, particle effects, a lot of the technical art. So just kind of all over the place.
What is rigging?
So rigging is putting bones inside a 3D or a 2D character so that the bones can like bend the mesh or deform the, if it's like a 2D puppet rig or something, they can like move the drawings around. So it's basically getting character art ready for animation.
So it's technical stuff.
Yeah.
That you directed. So you're a technical director.
Technically.
Brought it all back around.
That's some excellent segueing, Joe.
I'm just putting the pieces together, trying to figure this all out. I didn't know what rigging was, so that's interesting. I'm learning stuff today.
Yeah, it's a really deep discipline. I used to teach college, and I used to work in animation, so I had learned a fair bit of rigging from that, largely because I had to teach it. When you have to teach something, you tend to make sure you know what you're talking about, at least a little bit. But rigging's the kind of thing where, you know, basic rigging to make a character poseable is not terribly difficult, but the depth that you can go into with it, you know, you get into these like characters that might have bendy joints where you can just like grab the arm and flop it around because maybe during some really fast motion that looks better, or stretchy limbs, or there's this thing called FK and IK where you control, stop me if I'm getting too deep into this, FK
no,
and
no,
IK, which is, let's say I want to position a character's arm somewhere. With FK, which is forward kinematics, you basically grab each joint and rotate it. But what IK lets you do is it lets you grab the end of a joint or the end of a like arm or the end of a foot or something and just place that somewhere. And then the computer just figures out what the rotations of the arm needs to be to get that there.
That sounds really cool.
Rigging goes really, really deep. And then there's a lot of people who just build tools for automating rigging. And they're not rigging anything manually anymore. They're building programs that rig things, which is kind of that next level.
Was Fossil Hunters all manual rigging or automated?
It was all manual rigging. So we had not a lot of characters. We had, there's the 4 main characters and a handful of monsters. So we just rigged that all by hand.
the monsters. I wanted to bring those up. Those little crawler dudes. Fuck them.
Yep. They're pretty frustrating. Yeah. Was it level, probably level 4 is the one that got you, right?
Level 4, level 5, level 6. There were a bunch of them there in the dig site that, you know, you have fossils.
They eat your fossils.
They do, the little pricks.
Yeah.
But there's a trick to them, Joe. Did you learn the trick?
Yeah, you gotta shine the light on them to keep them away.
Yeah.
But still, if the light isn't lined up properly, those little sons of bitches will sneak in there and just start nabbing at the side.
Yep. Yeah, you leave your schematic away for too long and you might come back and it's all gone.
We had that happen. I played co-op with my oldest daughter, and like we had our dinosaurs, our fossils all laid out. They were properly aligned. We were trying to do one of the challenge quests. We'd already beat the level, but we'd went back to go do this challenge quest. And then we were like, oh, we only need like one more spine piece or whatever. And so we go digging for it and we come back and the spiders had ate everything except for our toes.
Oh, God.
There was just a row of toes.
Oh, no.
We just like, why? So it became like this constant struggle. That's one of the reasons I made number one co-op with me. I played the first few levels by myself, and then those spiders showed up, and I was just like, fuck these things.
Mm-hmm.
You're not playing that alone with the spiders eating your fossils. So then I was like, I threw a controller. Okay, I'm gonna need you to keep the spiders away while I go find the phone.
That's one of the things I love about watching people play the games. We've taken it to a handful of trade shows, and we'll get groups of people playing because, you know, 4-player local multiplayer co-op is, you know, a big hit at live events. Can you hear me okay with that noise in the background?
Yeah, it was getting loud there for a bit, but you are louder than the noise when you talk.
Okay, I'll just defeat the noise.
Fight,
yeah,
it.
One thing
fight.
That's really fun.
The noise is a spider.
Shine a light at
it with my broom, or yeah. But yeah, one thing that's really fun to watch in local multiplayer things is that without the game telling them to do it, or even me telling them to do it, people kind of assume different roles because people find out pretty quickly that when 4 people just dig blocks at once, it's just nonstop cave-ins and chaos. So usually we'll see someone is. They're the ones who they excavate, they dig everything. Another person is the people who pull the fossils out of the excavation and into the build area. Another person sorts the building and actually puts it together into a skeleton. Another person guards against the crawlers. And just seeing these kind of like roles automatically emerge is really, really fun to watch. It's really satisfying.
I got to see my kids actually do that on their own because we only have 3 controllers. So at one point, and I have 3 kids. So at one point, I was just like, "Here, you guys, see what you can do.
Do and, my work for me."
Yeah, I sat back and watched them. Well, I like to let them when it's kid friendly games. I like to see how they respond to it, and we don't get a lot of those. I play a lot of horror games, so I wanted to, you know, give them an opportunity to see how they thought of it and how they would play it. And I noticed that. You know, number one took to assembling things because, you know, she was older and she could, you know, figure out bigger, more elaborate patterns than her 2 younger sisters. So then she had number 2 just dragging shit to her all the time. And number 3's just walking around knocking down blocks left and right. And it was amusing to see them just kind of like fall into their own arrangement without any of them even saying anything about you're going to do this, you're going to do that. They just found what made them happy in the game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great when people find what they like to do.
I'm envious of your built-in multiplayer, Cole.
Right. You really just need to teach your cats how to play, I'm telling you.
I've been trying. It's just the lack of opposable thumbs and getting distracted by toy mice. It's an uphill struggle.
The sad thing is that happens with my kids as well.
What, toy mice distract them?
Basically.
You know that new Xbox accessible controller that they came out with recently?
Yes.
You seen this?
Yes.
You know, that might be the way to get your cat into video games.
Oh my God, right? That might be.
If anything ever was. I mean, I think that's
you
the
could just use like a laser pointer so and like point it to the right button and just let them jump on the button. See?
Joe, and then they'll fall asleep on the controller.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, sure. You got to take your licks where you can.
Okay. So I'm zeroing in on this cat controller thing. If you played that iPad game, there's an iPad game for cats. I can't remember what it's called. It's sponsored by a pet food company or something. But it's basically
some games that cats play, but I'm not specifically sure.
It's like little fish swimming around, and if you tap the fish, they kind of go under the surface and they go away.
My wife downloaded that. Yeah.
Yeah, and like the cat's paw works in the touchscreen.
See.
So there might be a whole lot of untapped potential for local multiplayer cat games. They can play with your cat, just by enticing them to use the iPad as a controller.
So is that what Reptoid Games is working on next?
I can't say that confidential. I've said too much already.
Since we are bringing up things that you said too much of already, the gems in the game that you unlock, I don't know the grammar for that. I saw where you guys posted on the Steam forums that there was a plan in the future to incorporate those gems.
Yes.
Can you tell us more about that?
I can. Yeah.
Yay!
The gems are, in the current game, the gems are used for the occasional, we call them gem slabs. It's basically you unlock something with a gem that usually blocks your way. But we're working on a content update right now. That should be going live before the end of the year, all goes well. And those gems are going to be really important currency for it. Because what we've noticed in all the Let's Plays we've watched, all the streams we've watched, all the even our analytics data we've collected about stuff, is that everybody takes their gems up to their lab and piles it on the table.
Exactly what my daughter did.
which we never told them to do. Everyone's just like, oh, I need to keep this safe. I know where safe is. I'll put it in the lab. Some people keep them in the elevator, but people tend to keep their elevator clear, which is, you know, it's very tidy of them.
I'm not alone in this.
Yeah, I keep one in the elevator in case I come across a gem slab so that I can unlock it. But then the rest I keep in the up at the lab. But I didn't start off keeping them in the lab. I started off keeping them all in the elevator. And then my daughter, when I brought her in to play with me, she was like, this is messy, and started changing my shit.
You know, and threw them all in a pit, right?
Yeah. No, she's like, put it, she's in the lab, like, rearranging the tables a certain way and putting the gems on the tables so that they're grouped by the type they are. And I'm like, I'm just going to throw that back in the elevator when you go to bed tonight.
Nice. It was the night before we launched on Steam. I was being very careful not to have any dramatic changes to the game because you don't want to like screw up stability. You don't want to create bugs at the last minute when you think you've squashed them all. My creative director, Simon, decided that it was of the utmost importance that all the furniture in the lab be draggable.
And there's, I was a little horrified for doing that on Xbox.
There is. So the night before we worked in all the furniture is draggable, and we created an achievement for it.
Yay, achievement. And
amazingly, it didn't break anything. So
that is a glutton for punishment is what that is.
Yep. The gems. Did you two watch the Kickstarter video or any of our kind of older pitches about it?
I have seen the new stuff.
So we did a Kickstarter back in I think it was August last year, and one of the things in our pitch there, it's technically the only thing we haven't delivered from our Kickstarter, so don't tell anybody because they might get mad. but we did deliver early on our Kickstarter, but anyways, the thing that was missing from our launch is a thing called Creative Mode. So Creative Mode is a lot like Minecraft Creative Mode. That's the kind of the inspiration for it. And it's a safe area, kind of off the lab, where you can eventually unlock all the fossils in the game in unlimited quantities on a big playing field that you can take pictures of and you can save. You basically get your own kind of lab where you can create whatever you like.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So gems are used for the unlocking of that stuff.
Oh, okay. So hang on to all those in the lab for a while.
Yep, absolutely.
Nice.
Yeah, you'll use them all up when the patch hits.
Are there any plans? Are there any plans for online multiplayer in the future?
I don't think so.
No,
which saddens me a fair bit. It's
I need to be able to push Joe into a pit.
It was a really hard choice to scope it out when we were first building the project, but it wasn't an area of specialty. Like wasn't something we were really comfortable with doing at the time. There are budget limitations as well, and it's just the way the game's been written. I think it would be too much just kind of ripping everything up to add it in now.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, I don't think we're going to make it. That being said, I have been watching. I actually don't have an Xbox One myself. It's the only console I don't have. But Mixer has this controller sharing feature now, where people can jump in on your, like, you can stream it with your friends, and over that connection, you can give them access to a virtual controller.
Mm-hmm.
So that actually allows you to play it online multiplayer with your friends.
Oh, I didn't think to use that for that.
Yeah,
the shared controller.
I haven't tried it, but I've read several articles on it. It looks really promising.
I know there was a thing on Steam too. Somebody had said there's like a third party app or something like that that you can use that allows.
That one's really cool too. So that's called Parsec. Parsec. And they're a really nice little company. I think they're out of New York. We chatted with them a bit. They're really friendly, but you can host on your computer. You can host a game, and then people come in and they just come in as virtual controllers, just like the Mixer thing. What's really cool about that is they're cross platform. So if you have like an Android phone, one of those like gamepad clips or something, you can have that join into someone's PC session.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah,
and you can do a lot of players. You can have someone on an Android phone. You can have somebody on a Mac. You can have somebody on a Raspberry Pi or something. So I think they have Raspberry Pi support, and they can all just join into one game.
Jeez.
And Fosslanders is pretty well suited towards because it has everyone shares the same screen.
Yeah, that's impressive.
So that we have tried out, and that works really well. I was pretty impressed by that.
That's pretty neat. It's crazy what technology could do these days.
Yeah, there's so much like attention on streaming right now that, you know, everybody's kind of rushing in and, you know, making their startups to try to make streaming do more than it does right now. So it's nice to see all that progress happening.
Is there any potential for Mixer Interactive features in the future?
I don't know enough about them to say.
Yeah.
Yeah, our console ports for PS4, Switch, and Xbox weren't actually done in-house. You probably noticed on the splash screen of the game, it says Smiling Buddha Games, as well as Reptoid Games. So that's another company here in Toronto. It's a company that did Use Your Words, actually. I don't know if you've heard of it.
Yeah, we actually had Julian and Brent on the show a while back.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, so Julian did our console ports for us.
That's cool.
Yeah, because he's the guy who knows what he's talking about for that kind of stuff, and he's got all the business connections, he's got all the know-how. So he did a really great job on those ports. It was really pain-free for us.
Does that mean after this, you're gonna go like send him an email and be like, "How do we put Mixplay Interactive in here?"
Yeah, I'll say, Julian, mix every feature. Do it, please. Thank you. Bye.
Easy peasy. That's how it gets done.
He's locked in the dungeon right now, just waiting for orders. Jumping back to the Kickstarter, I noticed one of the features on the Kickstarter page was unlocking new costumes and hats and items. Did that make it into the game?
So we got the palette swap kind of things are in there. So it's a bit of a cop-out as far as character customization goes. So we got the different outfits in there. Hats, I can't say right now. Hats will probably not make it in, but I'm trying to sneak it in. No promises, unfortunately.
Gotcha.
We got some cool hat designs I really want to make in there, though.
Will the hats have any kind of effects, or will they just be cosmetic?
The only effect we've talked about the hats is just one that has like a headlamp.
Yeah.
No,
that
we talked
would
about
be nice.
Yeah, we talked about a headlamp one, and we talked about one that like emits like sonic waves that scares away crawlers.
Oh God, yes.
Yeah. So people will be pretty interested in that, I suppose.
little crawler sons of bitches.
What was the decision to make there not be any kind of actual combat against the crawlers?
It's more of a like a guiding principle we had for the whole game is that, you know, it's every game for the most part has some kind of combat in it. It's really, really common. Just, you know, you have a problem. Oh yeah, you kill the problem. The problem goes away. Cool, great.
Poke it with a stick.
Yeah. So we kind of wanted to lean on problems like this and the kind of game design challenges that the players are faced with to be something that needs to be managed, not something that needs to be destroyed.
Well, you can totally push them into the pits.
Yeah, so you can push them into the pits. You can just knock them into like a lit area, and if they're in the light for too long, they'll just burrow and just get out of there. So they're kind of more of a thing that needs to be managed than a thing that just needs to be squashed or hit with a pickaxe or something.
I want to say I was disappointed that I knocked one into a cave-in, and I didn't get an achievement for that.
That would be a good achievement.
There were some good achievements in the game. I was really hoping something would happen when I did that.
Have you found the hidden achievement yet?
No, there's a secret one, and I'm not sure what it is.
One secret one. Let me try to give you a hint without giving it away. It's in the first level.
Ah.
Yep. And it's an object you have to find, but you can't drag it over the pit.
Hmm.
That might be too much already. But look for a special object. Look for an object that looks a little bit unusual.
Interesting. Speaking of looking for things, I know each stage has the little slips of paper that you could pick up. Some of them buried in dirt. Are those in specific locations, or are those randomized?
Those are specific locations.
Okay.
Yeah,
so we planted all those. You can use your journal to keep an eye on like whether or not you've collected them all. From watching the streams that people have been doing this time around on this launch, I don't know, this might just be a thing about Xbox and PS4 gamers that love their achievements. But more than ever, I've seen people like not wanting to complete a level until they get everything.
Yep. Which is
really cool to see. Watching a lot of our the Nintendo Switch streams and stuff that went out, because as you know, they have no achievements right now. People just kind of blow through things. They like the collector requests. They obviously need to get past levels, but the achievements get ignored a lot. So that would result in, you know, shorter play times and kind of less completionism. But it's been a lot of fun to watch the Xbox and PS4 players go, because they're super thorough. And it's cool. It's a good game to be thorough with, because there's a lot to find.
Yeah, I personally made it down to the Mushroom Caves and realized that I didn't find all of the slips of paper in the dig site, so I had to go back and get those stars on every level. I needed to do it.
That's what me and Number One were doing, too. Like, we were purposely pressing the start button and check, because it'll tell you if you've explored it 100% and how many of the collectibles you found, the notes. Mm-hmm. And so we were actually going back, and then we'd finish a level, and then we'd come back to go to the next level and be like, oh no, we missed this. We don't have a star. We have to go back to that one instead. So we were bouncing back and forth through the first several levels pretty frantically, just trying to like clean everything up because we didn't want to miss anything.
Cool. Yeah, that's great.
Damn it, I got my achievement for all of them, though.
So. I want to say, though, Number One was very disappointed when she realized that because she was in my game, she wouldn't get achievements too. She was just like, this sucks. I can't get achievements. Mom's going to get them all. I was like, well, I guess you're going to have to go load it on your Xbox and make your sisters play with you.
Yep, exactly.
Bonus points, at least you already know where everything's at.
Yeah. It's you could just go ahead.
Oh, man. Jumping back a bit, you said that you took this to a bunch of shows and expos. Do you have any really fun stories of people who were either really, really good at the game right off the bat, or people who were just awful at the game?
I think the thing that a couple of the things that came up again and again were parents who were bringing their kids to these trade shows. The kids, you know, we went to a couple of comic conventions, which don't usually have video games at them, but the audience is still the same audience, basically. So we're in a row of people selling prints or comic books or whatever, and a kid zeroes in on our booth and goes, "Wow, a video game!" And they all come start playing, and the parents just kind of sitting behind the kids while they play, you know, arms crossed, just looking, being quiet. And we say, "Oh, you should come play with them." They're like, "Oh, no, I don't play games." We're like, "Okay, that's fine. We're not going to make you play." The kids keep playing, and eventually, every time, the parent eventually picks up a controller. They say, "Oh, okay, let me see what this is all about."
I always find the whole "I don't play games" thing weird. I'm like, you never play Pictionary at a party. You never pick up your phone and play Candy Crush. Like, everybody plays some kind of game sometime.
Mm, absolutely. I mean, I think games with a gamepad can be kind of intimidating for people who don't play gamepad games. That seems like the barrier for some people. But yeah, no, everybody plays games. Games are part of life, right?
Yeah, I love, even my dad will be like, "Oh, I don't play video games." It's like, "Dad, you're the one who introduced me to ColecoVision." Yeah. Like, of course you do.
Got more cred than I do. Yeah, so we saw a lot of that. We got a lot of kids that just needed to be peeled away by their parents. That trick that the parents do where they say, "Okay, we're going. Put the controller down. We need to go." "Okay, I'm going. All right, see you later. Bye. We're going to leave here." Bye. The kid keeps playing.
But damn.
And then they look around and they go, "Oh no, I don't know where my parents are." We say, "It's okay. Just keep playing, and eventually they'll come back for you."
I know where they never did.
Yeah. Yeah, they just figure, "Oh, okay, well, whatever. That's a babysitter for my kid." Clearly it's going to work because they don't want to leave, so I'll go do what I want for a bit.
It is an interesting conundrum though, because you mentioned, you know, babysitter for my kid. There's not a lot of games, even ones that are kid-friendly, that are as kid-friendly as this one. Like, even my five-year-old was able to pick it up. And I used her as a metric, like, she's not a massive gamer anyway. Mm-hmm. This is a five-year-old that can beat Super Meat Boy levels, but she
played. Hey, wow.
Yeah, she's a little
ridiculous.
But
she's not a gamer?
She's totally a gamer. That's the problem. That is the problem. But that's why I always say I use her as a metric of kids can play, but she's a little above average for a kid that can play.
Yeah, probably much better motor skills than
But it was interesting to see her pick it up and just, like, she dove into it. She knew what she was going to do. She knew what needed to be done. She figured out how to play it quickly without having to bring up control maps and all that. She's just in it and gone.
I'm so happy to hear that.
And for a five-year-old, that's still a big deal, even one that plays regularly, to just be able to pick it up and play and know what to do is an impressive feat.
We worked really hard to make it, thank you, we worked really hard to make it intuitive, right? You'll notice there's almost no UI on the screen during normal gameplay. We don't have a whole lot of tips. We shoehorned some into the first couple levels to make sure people were using a couple controls that get missed, those trigger buttons. But for the most part, like, you can just kind of poke at things and experiment and learn how to play. And the consequences for failure, just kind of across the board, are really low.
Yeah.
You can die as many times as you want, and there's not really any problem. You'll just have no money.
That was actually what I ran into with number one, because she was just kind of haphazardly. This is my 14-year-old. My 5-year-old did a better job at staying out of the pit. But number one, she's just like haphazardly running across stuff and causing cave-ins, and she's like, "It's no big deal if I get crushed." And I'm like, "It is a big deal because I have no money." Lamps aren't free.
Are so there any other... Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. I'm done now.
I was going to ask if there's any other uses for the money in the game besides buying lamps, if there's like any purchasable upgrades or things that you could do in the future.
We had permanent upgrades at a time during development. We ended up taking them out in favor of those pools that you may have found some of.
Yeah, I found the one pool that lets me break everything in one shot, which I absolutely love.
Yeah. So we ended up taking up permanent upgrades for that. We're kind of playing around, seeing if there's a way to bring it back, but it was a little bit too kind of mechanic breaking, a little too game breaking. So there might be a better way to reintroduce that. The only thing to spend money on is the items, like you said. In the last world, the last biome, or whatever you like to call it, there is a character that will fish up fossils for you.
Mm-hmm.
And they take money. So they basically, they use our desire sensor that we call it to figure out what kind of fossil you need. And then for, I think it was like $100 or something, they'll fish it up for you and get you that fossil. And that's it in the current form. But money is also factoring in with the content update that we're working on.
Gotcha.
Do you care to elaborate a little more on the desire sensor? Because I've noticed its effect in the game, but would you care to describe it a little more for us and what it does?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So when we first launched the game, we got some pretty good reception for it, but kind of across the board, everyone complained that with the random fossil drops, it would not drop that last thing that they need. So let's say you're building that mm-hmm. like bird skeleton in the first mushroom level. It's like a big kind of like Toucan Sam kind of skull, mm-hmm. Middle joint, a foot, and a tail. You might get that foot, tail, and middle joint really fast, but that big Toucan Sam skull just isn't dropping, and you keep getting all the other fossils instead. So what we did is we set the drop rate based on the schematic that you have to build in that level. So if something had, you know, four bendy pieces, one skull and one tail, then we'll make the four bendy pieces drop more often than the skull and the tail. So we were able to, like, just through pretty simple math, make the drop rate technically do what it's supposed to. But it's random, of course, and random never feels very good. Usually the effect of pure random feels like it's trying to never give you exactly what you want, right?
Yeah.
So it might be that that thing that you need for 25% of the skeleton drops 25% of the time, but that doesn't mean that, you know, after four drops, it's going to drop. It means after, you know, a longer sample size will drop. Anyways, so this is a pretty, like, unsatisfying system where some people will just get stuck and it seems like your thing is never going to drop. So kind of inspired by what World of Warcraft eventually did, I think around the, I think it was like late Burning Crusade, maybe they did this. Is you get these quests in World of Warcraft where it's like, oh, collect, you know, 20 troll ears or something. Collect one troll ear, let's say. Collect this fancy thing, and you have to kill these mobs to get it. What they did is, the longer you are on that quest, they'll kind of set a time limit where this quest should take maximum 10 minutes. After 10 minutes, the drop rate of that item that may start with a really low drop rate will eventually approach 100%.
Oh.
So this idea that, like, it's going to make it, the system is capable of knowing exactly what you want. So let's just, within reason, give it to you so you can get along a little bit quicker. So we created this desire sensor thing, which basically every time it checks to see if it should drop a fossil or not, it looks at all the fossils in the environment. It looks at your schematic and your schematic progress and which slots are still open. And if there's anything that isn't in the environment and is needed for the schematic and not complete in the schematic, it's a 75% chance to drop that. And then a smaller chance to drop something that you may not want. So it's really heavily biased towards dropping exactly what you need, because it can mm-hmm. figure out exactly what you need.
That's helpful.
Yeah. So we immediately got, like, really strong feedback from that. People are like, yes, this feels better. This is great. In that same patch, we call that our quality of life patch. And those before we hit any of the consoles. We also added some other features that people really liked, like hold A to dig.
Yes, definitely helpful.
Which mm-hmm. is pretty important. It's kind of silly that we didn't launch with that, but you can just hold your button in front of a dirt block and your thumb doesn't get so tired.
That should come with a warning that you're more apt to cause escape hits doing that.
Yep. Then we added something else called grab assist. So when you go to grab something, if you're not quite in front of it enough yet, it will basically in the background kind of keep pounding that grab button as you get closer to it for a really short period of time. So it's really hard to see it working. It just looks like it's behaving normally, but behind the scenes, it's helping you grab stuff a little bit more.
Those are the best kind of features, though, that just kind of do what they should do naturally without you noticing it.
Yeah, it doesn't make the game any more complicated for the player, right? It just makes it feel better.
Right.
You don't necessarily need to know how or why.
It just works.
I really appreciated the desire sensor when I was playing with number one, there were a few instances where we would need one specific piece, and we would just tear through the whole map looking for it. We'd finally find it, and then we'd cause a cave-in and crush it. And then, like, we'd have to start all over again. And eventually it just got to a point where no matter how many times we fucked up and caused those cave-ins, the game just felt bad for us and would give us the piece pretty quickly again. Like, wow, you guys are bad. Here, take it. Just go.
Nice. So there you go. That's our next innovative system we're going to create. It's going to be the mercy sensor. Detect when bad things happen to you and give you a break after they happen.
That's the way to do it. Just take pity on the gamer.
Yep.
You just be like, I fell into the pit 5 times. Here's your fossils. Bye.
Yeah, it just rains fossils and money on you. Pity sensor is more like it, I guess.
Yes, the pity sensor. I wouldn't
be mad at that. I've played a lot of games that can benefit from a pity sensor.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man. I know we've been chatting for a while. Is there anything about the game that you wanted to talk about that we didn't bring up?
No, I'm probably good. We already touched on a lot of my favorite stories to tell about it. So,
any other fun stories you got?
We've been getting a lot of people asking about what other games we have. We've only been around a couple of years. We don't have a whole lot of games released, but there is one game that I encourage people to check out. It's called Spilltender, which is one of the one-week games that we made when we first started the company. You can find it on itch.io. I think if you just search for Spilltender, one word, you'll find it. It's a silly game we made where there's these weird-looking dudes at a table, and you have to slide beers to them as they ask for them. Kind of like that NES game Taps. So it's kind of like curling, where you have to slide the beer exactly to them, otherwise it falls off the table and smashes, or runs into a jar of peanuts and breaks or something.
Oh, God.
So that's a pretty fun other game that we have, if anybody wants to check it out, and that one's up for free.
And what do you guys have in the works for the future, or are you just focused on Fossil Hunters?
We have two original games that we're currently working on right now, other than the pre-production stages, as well as we're helping a couple of people out with their projects. So nothing to share with those yet, unfortunately. Very excited about those, though.
Are they planned for console?
Yep.
Yes.
Nice. Yeah. More achievements!
We've had a really good experience with console. Like, console is really cool. You know, we tend to prefer making controller-based games, and we kind of ran into a lot of resistance with our Steam launch on that. Mm-hmm. People say, oh, your keyboard controls are not very good. We say, well, the keyboard's not really the best device for playing this kind of game. So going to console, there's no friction there. I find generally the expectation for consoles, you know, the gamers are generally just nicer there, I find, as well. So I'm a big fan of console right now.
Nice. So are we. They're just easy to plug and play, and no complications, no specs. You just
enjoy. Yeah. It used to be that I loved firing up my PC. I had a big old gaming rig PC thing hooked up to my TV at home, and a wireless mouse and keyboard to sit on the living room table and say, oh man, I can do anything on my TV media center thing. This is so great. And then one day, you know, I just got sick of it. I said, you know what? I get home from work. I'm tired. I want to just play a game sometimes. I don't want to have to sit through a Windows update or wonder why this thing needs to patch or wonder why this thing stopped working. So, yeah, you got a PS4 or a Switch or an Xbox or something. You power it up. Maybe there's an update, but yeah, you just go. You buy a new game, you know it's going to run properly.
Damn right. That's what I love about console.
Yeah.
Everyone tries pushing me to be a PC gamer. I'm like, listen, I'm happy with consoles. They just work. That's all I care about, just working.
Yeah.
Buy a game, I mean, press start.
The thing I do miss about being a PC gamer is that games cost zero, basically. You know, if I want to buy a game like a year after it's out, it's probably popped up at a Humble Bundle and I can get it for like $5 or something. Whereas on console, things tend to stay, you know, $80 for a while.
Yeah.
That's why you gotta follow the right giveaway outlets.
Oh God.
Yeah. That's a good point. But I mean, when I buy a console game, I actually play it. My Steam library has an absurd number of games that I'll probably never play in it. So maybe it doesn't matter that they didn't cost as much.
Yeah, true.
As long as you're getting your money with money's worth.
Yeah, as long as you're having fun, right?
Oh man. Well, again, I know we've been chatting for quite a while. It has been a pleasure having you on the show, chatting with us. Was there anything else that you wanted to discuss?
No, I think I'm good. Thanks for having me.
It was a blast to have you on. Where can people keep up to date with you, what you're doing, the company, everything else?
Probably best bet is to check us out on Twitter. Just search for Raptoid Games on Twitter, and that's us. If you want to hear from me specifically, I tweet a lot about Unity development and game development. Some of the new toys that I buy for my desk every now and then.
Yay, toys.
I'm Ryan Thinker on Twitter. I recently bought an external GPU because I'm laptop bound these days, but I need some graphics power sometimes, and they're really cool.
I didn't know they had external GPUs.
I didn't either.
Yeah, my little dinky MacBook Pro has a awesome desktop class process or graphics card now that I can upgrade anytime.
Nice.
Very cool.
That is pretty cool. Oh man. Well, anyway, again, it was a pleasure having you on the show. Everyone else, stick around. We're going to take a quick break, be back with more show after this. Ryan, do you have any final words to wrap this up?
No, just have an awesome day, guys.
Welcome back, everyone. Thanks for sticking around. Thanks again to Ryan at Reptoid Games for joining us and keeping Cole and I company. A lot more show to take care of. As usual, we got the reviews, and we are starting things off. Pernell Vaughn, you're here. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. We're having a bit of a rainy season here because, frankly, I think we're getting the really, really, really mild residue from Hurricane Florence.
That shit was crazy.
Yeah, down there, they were getting pounded by rain. Up here, we just got a quick boom. It was okay, that was nice. Now it's just back to normal puddling. But even still, it's just kind of more rain, which ultimately isn't all bad, I guess.
Yeah, I like the rain. I like rainy days.
I do, too. What hurts me about rainy days, though, is I'm not concerned about water damage because I'm a paranoid schizophrenic when it comes to property. And right now, my drain, I need to clear my drain up top, but I do not have a ladder to go up two floors. So oh, boy. Get up there. So, whenever it rains heavy, the water overflows from the drain. And it's, pouring down the side of my house like a deluge. Just like a waterfall. It's and while it sounds awesome, I worry about what it means for the house. My dad was it's not damaging. I said, the hell it's not. I don't know what it's doing. More rain than expected is hitting the bricks. Maybe it's doing some shit. Maybe over the course of, 50 years, it's going to create a calcium effect on the bird. I don't fucking know. Point is, water is a force to be wrecked with, and it damages and ruins things. It ruins property, and it's always expensive to repair. Never fails. So I'm paranoid about it. I love rain, but fuck rain. Also, hey. But I will say on the positive, though, this was a surprisingly good week for games. Like, it's been, I've been stupid busy and like trying to like sort out all the schedule, like play this, play that, play this, play that. In the middle of that, trying to do the social thing. And also, I was like, I should try that Dragon Quest game too. So usually you're like, crap, I gotta do reviews though. Dragon Quest can wait, but these games aren't good. Well, that's not the case sometimes. Sometimes it's like, hey, these games are pretty good. And it's honestly been a pretty solid time, which is almost like a spoiler in its own right, but whatever. I just wanted to ramble about that. But
it's okay. You could ramble.
I like rambling. Thank you. But how about you? How's your week been treating you?
It's been hectic. My mom's moving, so I've been keeping occupied between either helping move or babysitting kids so that other people can help move.
Oh, boy. So I'll move if you can watch the kids. I'll move the furniture. Just take the kids away.
Unfortunately, my back problems mean that I kind of have to help out with the babysitting and take a break from the actual moving for a while.
But that's almost a danger in and of itself, because then you got kids running around, knocking over your stuff, being rambunctious bratty, and then you're like, stop, kid. He's like, oh, my back. And it's like, well, the kid knows. Now the kid knows your weakness, and they prey on it. They know your back's giving you problems. Like, well, I'm just going to do this thing just slightly out of reach of him. I'm going to mess with his stuff. What is he going to chase me? Like, but then, of course, you'll find a way. Oh, shit. But kids are, we were talking about that earlier, but kids are smart. People they underestimate know. Kids. They know. They know your limits. They know what you can and can't do. They know how to be jerks. They're good kids. I love kids. I love the cool kids. I love the good kids. But then there's those special children. The ones that not only know the rules, but are also bad. And they prey on it. They prey on it like vultures. And it drives me nuts.
Little bastards.
Little bastards. But hopefully those kids weren't that way to you. But the stories, man. I was playing Bob Ross, The Art of Chill, and a kid got under my skin. That shouldn't even be possible. The whole point of the game is to relax.
I didn't know there was a Bob Ross game.
Yeah, it's a board game, mind you, not a video.
Oh, okay. Okay.
But it's just like the idea is like you're mixing paints together and getting the right paint brush to make pictures and hopefully do it before Bob Ross does, which sounds more hectic than it is, but it's actually very relaxing of a game because I don't even feel like if I'm getting beat by somebody, I don't even care. I'm just like, I'm just getting these paint colors together. Oh, I got the chill bonus. That's pretty cool. Whatever. And then this kid comes along. He just ruins everything with his rambunctiousness and his, I'm going to peck at your nerves because you're not my mom or my dad. You can't do anything. And I'm like, well, I'll tell your parents you did something to get you in trouble. I don't have to be your parent. I can just lie as an adult, so don't piss me off. I know how to get under your parents' skin to get you in trouble. That's what it means to be a real adult. Don't need to be your parent to get you in trouble. Whatever, my ass. But I digress. Kids drive me nuts. The good ones are cool, but the bad ones drive me crazy.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, video games. We should probably talk about those, huh?
Games your kids should not play. No, not actually quite the contrary. I think some of these are games your kids should play.
You ready to do these?
Let's fire some balls.
Cool. First game to talk about is called Labyrinth of Refrain, Coven of Dusk, developed by Nippon Ichi Software, published by NIS America, released September 18th on the Switch for $49.99, plays the Tractatus de Monstrum, a living book owned by the conniving Dusk Witch Dranya, and confront the dangers lurking beneath the quiet town of Refrain. Assemble an army of up to 40 fully customizable puppet soldiers and wield unique skills, deadly magic, combination attacks, and powerful weapons to annihilate terrifying monsters and conquer the Labyrinth of Refrain. Purnell, what is this game?
This game, in a nutshell, is Nippon Ichi Software's at least to my knowledge, first crack at a dungeon crawler. And funny enough, I didn't even realize this until, like, let's say last month, I was in Los Angeles for E3. I went to a store in Chinatown out there. It was like an import game shop, and I saw a poster for this game on the wall, which kind of shocked me because it wasn't out yet. But it turns out this game was originally on the Vita in Japan. We got kind of screwed on getting it released here, and thankfully, they were like, hey, we're going to upscale this and throw it on the Switch and I think the PS4. But I wanted it portable. Here it is. And suffice to say, this game was worth waiting for. It's really cool.
So what do you do with it?
The idea is You are, well, the dungeon that is referred to in your description is beneath the town, and the concept is that humans cannot explore it because there's a miasma that floats around that will result in the humans dying from it. So what ends up happening is this Tractus de Monstrum is a book that is known to be previously owned by the only person to ever enter and get back out of the labyrinth. But weirdly enough, through a weird story event that they explain later on in the game, your soul is inside of the book. So the book is actually you. And the witch throws you, the book, into the well. And the book then can be used to summon puppet soldiers, which are used to explore the dungeon. That sounds simple. It is not. And yet it actually kind of is. So the way this works is, like, if you think of a typical dungeon crawler, you will have, you know, your set of party members, typically composed of by classes, a variety of classes. You construct the characters and you manipulate them through the dungeon. Mm-hmm. This game does something a little different, though. What it actually does is, instead of being humans, like you mentioned, they are puppets. And every puppet is created by a combination of puppet parts, which are an item you find or buy, and a soul that you find. Souls can come in different qualities, and the higher the quality, the better your base stats when you make the puppet soldier. And then you attribute it one of six different classes, possibly more, wink, wink. And once you do that, you kind of can choose an appearance for it, a voice for it, a lucky number, which I have no clue what the hell it does. So different starting stat or skills, rather. And even crazy things I'm not even used to. Like, you can choose the rate at which stats increase on the guy. So you might say make a mage, and the mage is typically good with intelligence and intelligence and constitution. I'm just saying that. And its base stat growth method would be like, you know, attack. I'm sorry, like S in magic, S in constitution, and like B in, like C in attack. But you might want to choose one of the other options, which will make it, you know, like A in magic, but B in attack. And basically it shifts around the rate at which their stats grow. Mm-hmm. A lot of number crunching there, but at the same time, if you don't want to deal with the number crunching, you can just set the base one and have fun anyway. Because it's most likely only going to matter for post-game stuff, as Nipponichi games tend to do. So you basically take these characters, you create them, and you throw them into the game. And normally, they will get whatever skills they learn at level up, which seems to be consistent for everybody. It's like level 8, you'll get a skill, and level 15, you'll get a skill, so on and so forth. But the thing that makes this game really weird, as far as how parties go, is that you don't just put a character into your party. You put a character into something called a coven, and that consists, that is the slot in your party. So you're probably thinking, what the hell is a coven? So,
yep.
That's why I've asked. I want you to say, like, what the hell is a coven? So as you explore dungeons, you will find scrolls hidden in certain chests. Maybe an enemy will drop it or whatever. And what these scrolls are coven packs. It might be called, like, you know, the wizard coven. And the idea is that whenever you put a puppet or puppets into this coven, it will get a specific stat boost. So let's say, for example, the Wizard Coven would increase all of your magic attacks by 15% damage. You put three, and it can support up to, depending on the coven, it can support up to three, you know, people in the front and four people in support. Support guys are just there mainly for stat boosting and the like, and the physical, the guys in the front are there for, like, attack power and damages and certain skills. So for the Wizard Coven, let's just say, make it up, it has two slots. You put two puppet characters in there, and the wizard coven could have skills attributed to it. So by getting in there, you might also be able to use fire magic, a fire spell, a wind spell, and a rock spell. Boom. By being in the coven, you have this act, you have access to these spells. Now, let me know, by the way, if you feel like, what the hell is he talking about? Because this is a weird game to describe.
But wow, this sounds really cool.
So you then take the coven and you put it into the slot for your party. So it's five slots, and each slot can be a coven. And depending on how cool the coven is, determines how much value it has, which the game gives you a stat of 100. And based on the number of covens you put in, you set up to go into the dungeon, determines how much you can afford. So you can't have, like, all these super covens later in the game and expect to just take them all in, because the game intentionally will prevent you from just doing that, because you don't have enough, you know, reinforcement points to send the entire set of covens into the dungeon. But ultimately, you take the guys, you sit them in the dungeon, and when you submit an attack, the coven attacks as a whole. Now, one thing I didn't realize until I got further in the game, because I wasn't thinking about it, is, like, when you do a skill or something, like I said, the entire coven attacks as one. So five different covens, five different commands you can set up. But let's say, for example, you don't want the whole coven to attack as one. What if you want to say, I don't know, use an item, because I didn't know how to use items till like 20 hours in the game. You have to do something called individual action instead, which allows each character in the party to do their own thing, but it prevents you from using the coven action. So they can do their own individual attacks or like use an item, or but you can't use like special coven abilities. So you set those guys up. In addition to that, there's other weird things, which I probably don't want to ramble too much on, because if I do, I'll be talking about a bunch of nonsense mechanics and not other cool components of the game, which is that as you explore the dungeon, you pretty much are just trying to get further in. The game might say, for example, for this particular moment, you need to find a nice item and take it back to Dronia to examine. So you'll explore the dungeon until you find this item, and then once you find it, the game will say, it's time to proceed backwards or whatever. And then once you fulfill the mission, the story on the surface will take place, where Dronia and her assistant Luca are, I'm like, it's not much to say, otherwise I'm spoiling, because the game pretty much starts you bare bones, where you're working for the mayor of the town, with the intent being to explore the dungeon on his behalf to find special treasures to give him. And that opens up to like a surprisingly deep story. It starts out simple, but it becomes anything but. Every time you fulfill a mission and come to the surface, you do like a witch report check, and that allows you to progress the story. So let me think, how to describe some. Give me a quick question, because I have a lot of thoughts in my head, but I need a focus point. Give me something to focus on, because this game is weirdly big.
Is it fun?
Oh, God, yes. This game is a ton of fun. I really enjoy customizing the characters. For those who are familiar with Nippon Ichi, you know that most of their RPGs are composed by Tenpei Sato, and this is probably one of the best works he's ever done as far as I'm concerned. I love all the music in this game. It makes me want to keep playing it more. There is, for those who are familiar with Disgaea, if they had the Dark Council or whatever, I never get the damn name right, but the Dark Council where you could put in petition votes in using mana points. In this game, they have something called Witch Petitioning, where every once in a while you can spend mana that you accrue in the dungeon to fulfill a witch petition, which will allow you to do certain things. Like, the game gives you certain skills, some of which can be acquired through the petitioning, which kind of break traditional dungeon exploration. So, for example, at one point, you know, the character's like, oh, like the book comes back to report to the witch, and she's like, oh, I see, you can't get to the next location because it's blocked off. Oh, there's too many walls in the way. Well, just start smashing the walls, and you get the ability to just break dungeon walls. Just walk up to the wall and bust a hole in it, which is very unlike dungeon crawlers. I can't think of a dungeon crawler where it just lets you break almost any wall you want. Of course, the thing they limited you with is, every time you use the wall-breaking skill, it costs you a certain number of reinforcement points, which, again, there's a cap, and when you run out, you can't do it anymore, so you have to be smart about it. And you also can't just, like, typhoon through and smash every wall, leave the dungeon, and come back, because they all repair themselves. But for the frustration removal point, even though the walls regrow, if you come across a room behind a destroyed wall, and you go in, it stays on your auto map, so it still shows all the places you can go. You just have to smash the wall to get back in. And, of course, there's typical like dungeon jumping and things of that nature. But I really like this game. I like playing it. I like the music. I enjoy customizing my little puppet party. And the only thing that makes me sad, though, I'm home. Well, I just wish there were more designs for the puppets. Because at 40 puppets total in the party eventually, and you're sitting here making new puppets, you're going to eventually be like, okay, well, of these six options for this type, only like three of them, but I need four of that guy. So two of them are going to look exactly the same. Screw it. I like that style of Astronite so much. I'll have two of them, and I'll name them Demona A and Demona B.
Oh, it'll God. Be cool.
But it's a lot of fun. It does a number of things that typical dungeon crawlers don't, which you'd expect Nippon Ichi to do. Again, the coven system is very unique. It changes, to me, the way in which you will divide the party. And you can go in any number of ways. If you want to be micromanaging, meticulous, you can be like, okay, I'm going to have a Astronite and a Marginal Maze and the Theatrical Star in one party. Or you can just say, screw, I want three punchers in there. Three people that can punch. And they can sit in the party and have fun. If you want to, basically, I'm saying, if you don't want to get complicated, you can just throw whatever you want in there and just make it work somehow. And of course, just like in like this guy, you can increase the difficulty if you want by spending, you know, go to the wish petition and request it. So if you want to be challenging where you need to be really meticulous with your stuff, but be rewarded with better drops and the like, well, guess what? Wish petition that shit up, get difficulty up. But it's just, it's good. I'm having, just like, there's just a lot that happens in this game, like as far as like customization goes. And yet at the same time, it's actually not that complicated. You also forgot to mention you can also use like reinforcement points to also increase your defense and attack in combat. But again, rationing because a lot of stuff tapped from that pool.
Yeah.
Oh, I need to mention too before I forget, in case, because I might run out of time on this review, is that when you're exploring the dungeon, one weird thing they put in there is that every time you go to a floor in the dungeon, as you're running around, you're collecting mana. Mana is overflowing throughout the dungeon, and you use mana for things like witch petitioning and other certain things. But every floor has a certain cap that you can have. So you're smashing walls, getting mana. You're killing monsters, getting mana. You're finding mana deposits. But the floor maxes you out at 5,000 mana, and you happen to get 5,010. What happens? Death comes after you and tries to kill you.
Oh, Jesus.
So basically, the game will punish you for being greedy on hoarding mana in dungeons. So don't go into a dungeon and expect to just mana grind to your heart's content. They put that in place to keep you from just kind of hoarding it and just doing things whatever you want. You have to be kind of smart about it, because if you're just running around grabbing it on a whim and then eventually go a little bit further down the dungeon, you might catch yourself off guard hitting that cap, and then it's time to run because death don't play, and it's not easy. It's pretty cool. I mean, like, I feel like if you're not stupid about it, you'll probably never encounter death. Like, I kind of had to force it to happen to me by just, like, intentionally letting it go up. But I think if you're just not grinding for it, it probably won't happen. So, but at the same time, maybe I haven't tried it, but I wouldn't be surprised if you can actually beat them in some way. Like how Persona does it with their spirit, the death spirit that chases you around.
Well, so, that's your homework for next week, then. You got to fight death.
You know how many people have tried it over the years? They've all died. No one's beaten death yet. And if they have, they ain't telling. Probably because it's a secret that'll get them in a lot of trouble.
Well, we'll find out next week, I'm sure. But $50 on this one. What is your official verdict?
Oh, this is so damn worth it. If you like NES games, buy it. If you like dungeon crawlers, buy it. If you like crunchy numbering things, buy it. It's a good game.
Crunchy numbering things.
Yes, crunchy numbers. And just thinking about number management, min-maxing, all that beautiful stuff.
Nice.
I was rambling up, but I like the game that much, I guess. It brings out the rambler in me.
It's good to hear you enjoyed it. That just means all your other reviews are going to have to be shorter now.
Dun, dun, dun.
Because the next game to talk about is called Old School Musical, developed by La Moutarde, published by Playdius. Hopefully I said that name right. La Moutarde. I don't know. These names. I'm telling you.
This will be his cute ass. He say, everyone, if you like my game, here's how you say the creator's name. That's me.
But this one released September 13th on Switch and Steam for $12.99. What has 50 amazing chiptune tracks, a loony story mode, 32 different types of chickens to fight, and takes you on a tour of all your favorite retro games. It's Old School Musical. Tib and Rob are the heroes of a wacky adventure that will teach them where all of the bugs in our favorite games come from. Pernell, what is Old School Musical?
I'm actually kind of glad that the description mentions the chickens, because that's probably one of my favorite levels I did in the story was like something out of Legend of Zelda where the chicken army locks Link up. Whoever the guy who's supposed to be Link, they lock him in a cell and you have to save him It's like Klein or something, but he's basically Link. And basically this guy's been known to be like just a massacre chickens. But Old School Musical is what I believe gameplay-wise to be the creation of a person who really liked Guitaru Man and really missed the fact that he couldn't play another game since then that had the style of gameplay the defense mode had. And you're probably like, what the hell are you talking about? But whoever who's listening to this episode who's played Guitaru Man already knows what the hell I'm talking about.
Oh, I know what the hell you're talking about.
Yes, I love that so much. I was like,
yeah,
I was
Guitaru Man.
Yes. And this game's main gameplay, or pretty much all of it, it plays in that style. As you're playing it, whether it's the story mode or the arcade mode, where you can just select the number of different tracks you want to listen to. The idea is that there is pretty much like a plus axis, and buttons are coming in from the left, right, top, and bottom of the screen. And as the buttons come through, they represent up, down, left, and right. It never gets mixed up, from what I can tell, at least, where it's always going to be right from the right, left from the left, or whatever. You have to
as
press.
As it should be.
No, sometimes it was. I shouldn't say it because it's kind of jerky when it's not. And I can't for the life of me remember if Guitaru Man asked he ever mixed that up by making like square on like the top or something. But nope. I digress. As the buttons are coming to the center, you have to press them in time with the song. And sometimes you have to hold the button down. Other times you have to like, kind of hit it in succession, like rapidly. And both Joy-Cons work for the same like up, down, left, right, you know, button styling. So you can press right on the left side or the A button on the right side of the Joy-Con. They both represent right. So, and you'll need that because sometimes like the button combinations will be so quick you need to alternate between the two. But other than that, occasionally also the game will switch to trigger input and the buttons will come from the bottom to the top, kind of like Beatmania in reverse. And you have to hit the trigger buttons in representation of where they when they cross over like a certain line. That's the entirety of the gameplay. But that's not a bad thing because you're hitting these buttons to the beat of some awesome chiptune tracks. And I didn't even realize it until later on that these are like actual chiptune artists. This isn't like some company who came up with an OST. These are chiptune artists who submitted tracks for the game.
Mm-hmm.
And these tracks range from okay to really freaking good. There was a level in the story mode that was made to kind of be like Outrun, and the track, I won't say it was like, I'm not sure if these tracks are even meant to be inspired by some of these games, or if it's just they put them there because they just wanted to, but this Outrun level track was really freaking good, and I played it multiple times. The story mode is basically Tib and Rob are separated from their abusive mother, and they are tasked with locating her across multiple video game themed inspired worlds. But unfortunately, as they go into each video game world, a strange glitching situation occurs, causing the world to kind of collapse on itself, and they end up having to escape the world. So that's usually how every level takes place. You might, let's say, for example, there's like a Metal Gear style level where they're like, hey, where's mom? And like, the major hits them on like a telecom, like, hey, I don't know who you guys are, but I need your help. Rescue some soldiers from the base. And it's like, we don't want to do this. It's like, well, the supercomputer that's inside might have information on your mama. And it's like, well, I guess we can do that. And then there's a music stage. Breaking into the base a la Metal Gear Solid 1 on the video in the background, playing to the beat of a really cool track called like Savant. And it's just legitimately good. Like, I enjoyed playing to the beat. The only downside I had, if anything, which isn't really a problem, is that it's pretty cool videos that happen in the background sometimes inspired by some of our favorite video games, but you're so busy hitting the musical notes that you're not going to have the time or the energy to see it. You have to focus on the game you're actually playing. I guess that's kind of like how Beatmania is too, how like videos will play. It's like, I can't focus on it. I'm playing the game, but it doesn't hurt the game. It just makes you wish you could see those videos in better styling, like without being disturbed by the game you're playing, but it's not a problem. It started out kind of meh for me as far as the story mode goes, though. But as it went on, and I was able to focus more on just the writing between the character dialogue as they entered each world, as he started to kind of chuckle and enjoy it. It was a lot of fun to actually sit there and see them, how they wrote stuff. There was like an Outrun world where the idea was that it was a race where the whole point was that all the racers insulted each other. So it was just the characters insulting each other back and forth. And that was the story as they were driving cars like, your mom is so fat. Like, wow, mama fat jokes. I haven't heard those in a minute.
Oh,
this
God.
Is good. But it's a quality game. There's a lot of, the story mode has like 20 something stages in it. And there's more songs you can unlock as you play the game in like those other side modes, the challenge modes and like the arcade mode. So there's a lot of content here. And of course, there's three difficulty levels. For me, I didn't see myself having a lot of difficulty with any of the songs I played. I did mostly normal mode, but I did a couple of the hard mode tracks too, being like, let's say if there were like 10-star difficulty, it's like a number of 8 and 9s. And I wasn't having too much trouble, but I also play a lot of music games.
Yeah.
But the point of me saying this is to say that the game is designed where that the base difficulty, I think anybody can appreciate and enjoy and play through the game. So you're not going to be struggling. It's just meant to enjoy. But then there's a higher difficulty for people who just want to like, oh, crap, I'm going to mess up my Joy-Cons or whatever. that's your flow. But ultimately, the game itself is a very, very quality mix. I should do the summary part.
Yeah, $13 on this one. What do you think of it?
I think it's a guaranteed buy, but that goes doubly for anybody in the game music scene that loves chiptunes. It's the idea that you're getting a game that has original chiptune compositions in it. How often does that even happen anymore?
It doesn't happen
very often. This is worth your money, even if it's just to hear the music.
Yeah, this one is on my wish list. The wife gets paid on Friday, and I will be grabbing it post-haste on Friday. And you know a game is going to be good when even the PR person from the PR company is like, this game is really good.
Ow! So he was even giving it the hype train.
Oh, yeah.
Well, he was right about this. This was not smoke up a butt. This was fantastic. Worth it.
I am glad to hear that it is as good as they say.
Mm-hmm. And prepare to laugh at chickens, because there are other descriptions. There is that section of the game. I loved it. Chickens were great. They remind me of Breath of Fire for some reason. It's good.
Nice. Next game to talk about is called Revenant Dogma, developed by XCreate, published by Kemco, released September 12th on Xbox One and Windows 10 for $14.99. I'm sure it'll be appearing on other platforms as well. Kane enters a rune site in search of a feral relic said to be left behind by the gods and meets a mysterious girl in a mask. This strange encounter becomes the catalyst for a grand scheme that will change the worlds of humans and Therians. Will this newfound power lead to prosperity or destruction? For now, what did it lead to?
It led to a conflicting situation. So I'm going to talk about it, and hopefully you can chime in with some thoughts too. So the idea behind this game is that if you were to think of, let's say, a classic SNES type of RPG, you're probably going to get something like that out of this game. It starts out pretty much in earnest. Like, the game pretty much immediately kicks you off of falling into a ruin. And you and, like, basically Kane and Julia are exploring this ruin, and they stumble across the third party member in the form of, like, a situation where they have to fight a boss, and they rescue her, and then things kind of snowball. Like, you get your party together pretty fast, and things just kind of happen. But while I wasn't finding myself gripped by that styling, though eventually I did kind of find it to be more enjoyable as I got further, and it's one of those weird things where I started to care about the characters unexpectedly, because I was like, I'm not really feeling this. But I digress. The combat system in the game is actually pretty cool, though. I do like the combat system. So the idea is that as you're playing the game and you get into a battle, you can eventually get transformation skills. The transformation skills are different, let's call them costumes, that when you put them on, your character will take on a different representation. Like, there might be the knight transformation or the healer transformation. Think like RPG classes. Mm-hmm. And when you make the transformation occur, it will augment your stats in a certain way. Like, the healer might increase your intelligence by 30% and all your other stats by 5%. And when you make this transformation occur, in addition to all those stats bumping up and your attack going up, you also, as you level up, gain new skills that can only be used while you're in those class forms. So the Guardian class for Kane might offer him an ability that will boost everybody's attack power up by like one stage or something. The downside to using these skills or these transformations on a regular basis is that there is like a limit gauge that's attributed to each one. And when you transform into the guy, I think it goes up like an immediate 30%. And every time you use an actual skill, it goes up a little bit more. Once you hit 100%, you can't control the character anymore, and they kind of lose their marbles.
You just go berserk mode.
Pretty much. They never attacked me in the rare case where it happened to me, but I wouldn't put it past the game to allow them to do so, because by the time it actually eventually happened to me, I had a skill to reduce the limit gauge, so I was like, okay, not taking a chance, get that shit down. So I was able to reduce the incident for possible problems. So when you do this, it's basically a nice little dance of like balancing when to transform into a character, when not to transform into a character, or when to just attack with base. So as you're exploring the game and playing through it, it typically runs into a situation like, okay, here's a story element. They give you a goal where you need to go next. You walk there. And every once in a while, you might get a side quest from someone in town. Like, it's usually one side quest, possibly two per town, but it's usually one. And they might say something like, hey, find my child. They've gone lost. Find them in the cage you just came out of. So you go back and you find the kid. And when you take them back, you might get a reward in the form of like a cool item or something like that that you can equip. And you can equip weapon, armor pit, accessory item, and something that I don't know what it's supposed to be, so I just call it candy. It looks like an unwrapped piece of candy. And in that slot for my main character, for example, I gave him a super rare gem. which gives me a better rate of getting good item drops from monsters. So you can equip things in that manner, but in addition to like the normal stuff like that, you can augment your weapons. So you might say take your main sword and go to the blacksmith, or strangely enough, you can also do it in the field. They have a blacksmith, but you can do the same thing in the field, though I guess only the blacksmith can dismantle it, but I digress. You can equip gems or different like augmentation items to the weapon to give it a higher attack power, or to give it different buffs like recovery when you walk, or better damage against certain monsters. And sometimes there's even negative effects that'll come on a weapon, which you might want to use gems to negate. But you find a lot of weapons as you progress the game, and unfortunately, they typically have the same name. So to give an example, like, you will get your typical Trum progress. Let's say you'll go from the small sword to the light sword to the bronze sword. But you'll get a lot of light swords, and you'll get a lot of small swords. And each one will come with their own different sets of combinations. Like, I have this one here I'm looking at. It gives me an encounter rate increase of 9%, and it reduces damage by 9%. But then the next small sword gives me continuous turn boosting, instant kill of certain monsters, and a strength boost of 1%. So you'll get a number of combinations of things. And you can equip new gems on them, up to 4, to give them different skills and abilities. Or dismantle them and then hopefully pass the effects to other weapons if you want to make a weapon's effect last beyond the strength of the weapon itself. I don't know if this game... I think it was originally a mobile game.
Yeah.
And I don't know if the game originally had a pay real money to get things. But I want to believe it did. And this game did not keep that, but it kept what the money did. And you're probably, what the hell are you talking about? And I'll explain. Every couple of fights, let's say every 5 consecutive fights, you'll get 10 RP, which are considered revenant points. And there's a store in the menu called just the shop. You can go there whenever you want. And when you go to the shop, you can go to purchase item, and the game lets you spend the revenant points you earned on different gear. Like, you might buy new items to augment your weapon, or you might buy some healing items, things like that. Like, I'm looking at one that just adds hit points to your party member. And then you can do what I did, which was buy 3 experience rings, which gives you experience points. Oh, sorry, 4 experience rings. And each one, when you equip it, gives you experience points as you walk.
Which is exactly what I did.
Smart man. Yeah, look at all this. I was like, why do anything but that? This makes sense.
Which actually leads me to one of my minor complaints with the game is that those things made it way too easy. Like, you're going into these transformations and these augments and everything else, and 90% of the battles I would go into, I would just automatically win because of how fast I leveled up and how powerful I got so quickly that I never even had to mess with any of that stuff.
I agree with you. I will say that later on, the bosses start to kind of muck with that a little bit more. Like, it doesn't, like, well, one thing we might have did different, like, I put it on hard mode to start. You might have left it on normal, I'm imagining, right?
Yeah, I left it on normal to start, but yeah, I bumped it up to hard after a while.
Ah, yeah, because on hard, I would say about halfway to 3/4 of the way through the game, enemies start to become more jerkish, and it's like I'm not sure if it's the EXP ring kind of tapering off and balancing out, which if that is the case, that still seems like a weird thing to me. Like, when you put those rings on, your experience just skyrockets. Like, you're like leveling up every 2 to 3 battles, and then around like level like 25 or so, it kind of tapered off. It slowed down a lot, and the enemies were like, nope, we're ready for you with this shit. And I was actually having to do a little bit more work. Like, one boss was like, I'm going to drop everybody's defense and everybody's speed, and if you don't get that defense back up, he will wreck you. So it's like, okay, start using these guys. Like, use this girl's skill to ask Julie's skill to actually put defense and speed back on a person. But you can only do one per person, so you're dawdling to get it done. But it's interesting. Like, a lot of the mobs are still pretty much chumps, but certain bosses be like, okay, well, I know you've been leveled up, but I don't give a shit. I want to give you some problems. I'm not sure if it's just the review copies that started us with the 1,000 RP, or if it's... If everyone,
I think that's just how the game is.
Okay, good. Otherwise, because I would feel weird if it wasn't everybody, because it's one thing to have something to start and then earning more, but if it was just earning from 0, it would take a long time to get some of this stuff.
Yeah.
Because, again, you get 10 or so per every 5 battles, and I think I've done, I don't even know, maybe like 1,000 battles, more or less, give or take, and it's, I still don't think I had enough to really like put a dent in this list. especially if you want to try to like upgrade some of your weapons using the items that are on this menu. Like, I wish I could buy that. I wish I bought that ultimate crystal sometimes because it would make your attack really high. but yeah, I feel like this system is like a double-edged sword because on one hand, it's good that it's there and they should start you with enough points to put it to use. But at the same time, as we both experienced, that experience ring can kind of break it early on, if not throughout the entire game. But I'm surprised how I feel about this because on one hand, I was ready to like not be fond of it, if that makes any sense. I was like, it's just kind of like trying to hit the RPG classic notes. Is it really working or is it just doing what, you know, is it just tapping the right spots to make me appreciate it, even if I'm not really enjoying it? But then later on in the game, I did find myself feeling like I wanted to win battles and I wanted to go to the next story point, even though there were some weird decisions in the plot layout that I kind of felt like why is this character motivated to do this? That doesn't make any sense. I'm not going to spoil it because I feel like it would be a spoiler, but let's just say you're trying to help somebody early on and then it turns out that's like, not quite. I don't care that much about you after all. And I'm going to be a dick about it to you and your friends. it was like, that doesn't even make sense as a motivation. It's just, why would they do that? But I guess they had to write that, you know, hero has a problem, how to save it, you know, without doing a ton of stuff with it because it just kind of happens.
Yeah.
The game is meant to be, because the game is not too long. So it doesn't have time to do like all the crazy ramp ups and setting the stage for the world. It just kind of puts you in it and things happen. But I will say this though, because I'm not sure how people might be listening to me and going, this guy ragging on, is he enjoying it? And I'll say this. It hits all the notes you'd expect an RPG, a classic style RPG to hit, in the sense that if you're looking for a classic style RPG with combat and a nice skill system and the style, that old classic style of graphics, you're going to get that here. I will say that the battle graphics they're described as like stunning and like really fantastic. They're okay. I like the character models, but the enemy models could use some work. But I did feel as though nonetheless that I was getting the feel of something I would have played on like the old Super Nintendo or something like that, or maybe like the first gen PS1
Enjoy out of Kemco RPGs. They keep that 16-bit classic RPG flavor. And that's what I'm looking for. Like, I'm not super fond of modern day RPGs that are more action based and open world and everything else. I kind of just like the simplicity of the retro RPG.
Yeah, time the button presses or whatever. But like, and I agree with it. I think that's part. That's what I was mentioning before. Like, I feel like they hit the notes that you expect them to hit, and as long as you're cool with that and the combat, you'll have fun with this, I think, because I ultimately did have fun with this. I even like the fact that it has a, I feel like it's kind of underutilized, but the battle system has one of those Grandia-esque systems where the main characters have a timeline. Let me start. Ramble time, shit. There is an actual, like, time progression meter at the bottom of the screen. Heroes are on it and the monsters are on it. And every time a person takes an action, the character icons move over until the next person's turn comes up, which means that there are skills, and by skills, I mean, I've come across like very few, that can ultimately hinder the enemy's turn progression and slow them down. So you can like push them back in the order of operations here. So if you need a heavy hitter to kill a guy before he hits you, make Lilith slow him down. Use her stun edge to knock the guy back in the order of operations, and then the main character can come and just whack his face off before he can do anything. So I like that aspect of it too, because it reminds me of like one of my favorite battle systems that I've ever played in turn-based game. So my feeling on the actual review as a whole is that if you are looking for a real retro-y RPG, I think you can find it here. And I don't think there's a ton of them out there that are doing this, that are on consoles. I think if they are, they're all Kemco RPGs.
Yeah, for the most part, yeah.
So, and this is probably one of their better ones. So I would definitely say give this one a shot. If you are looking at, like, again, like you mentioned earlier, like if you're looking for like, okay, well, I want classic with modern conventions, you're not going to find that here. This is retro to retro. Like, they're not rewriting the script in any way here, and you're not going to get it. So don't come looking for it. And I guess the best way to describe it, as far as like when I think of the story, think of how I'm sure you can think of a couple of your RPG classic favorites from back in the day where the plot just kind of starts happening and there's no like heavy world building or anything like that. It's just, hey, things are great. And then holy shit, they're not. This game does that in a nutshell, like wholeheartedly. So like, that's what I meant when I said I'm conflicted on like the general review score, because I had fun playing it, but I also played it because I was reviewing it. And it's hard to say how others would take to it. So maybe I consider it as a try it.
Works for me.
Well, there we go. Let's go with a try it then.
Sounds good. One final game for you to talk about is called Super Dungeon Tactics, developed and published by Underbyte Games. Released September 13th on the Switch for $19.99, also available on Xbox, PS4, and Steam. Super Dungeon Tactics is a classic turn-based game featuring exciting new gameplay mechanics. Along with traditional RPG characters making you feel right at home, the dynamic gameplay will keep you on your toes. Purnell, what the hell does that mean?
I don't know, but I can tell you what, this game is pretty cool. So, they give a little bit of pretext on this review. So, Super Dungeon Tactics is based off of a board game that came out some years ago called Super Dungeon Explorer. Super Dungeon Explorer is pretty pricey, but at the same time, it comes with some really cool character models and character art for like the cards and like baubles and the such. I don't have money for that. And I also have trouble getting people together to play that game if I bought it. Fortunately, though, this particular game doesn't require friends, and it doesn't require $70 or $100 to buy it off the shelf. It just requires whatever the asking price is on the console, which is like, what, $20?
Yep, $20.
And you're getting a pretty cool game out of it. So the idea is that the story isn't much to write home about. The idea is that you are adventurers in the woods killing kobolds, and you come across a hidey-ho town that no one knows exists. And these people are like, the forest protects us, monsters will never show up. And then like one of the main heroes is like, are you sure? Because monsters are angry and they'll attack if you let them. And then what do you know? The monsters get angry, so they attack. And that results in your party characters forming a guild in the town to help push back the monsters and hopefully stop the advancement forever, which is pretty simple, but I don't care because I'm here for the gameplay. And the gameplay is pretty cool. So between every level, there is like a map that pops up, and you can choose between like a bounty quest or a side quest or a main quest. And these are just what you typically would expect in a tactics-based RPG. Like a bounty might be go hunt down these guys, and if you kill them, you'll get X amount of loot rewards or whatever. And the main storyline quest will be quests that advance the plot. And as you play through the plot, you'll acquire new characters that fulfill different classes, like the barbarian or the rogue or the magician or the berserker or whatever. And when you equip these characters with items, you already immediately start to notice one thing that's weird about this game compared to typical tactics-based role-playing games, which is that there are dice involved. Now, they reduce the effect of dice in this game compared to the board game, but how this works is if a character has no equipment on, they have a coin that is flipped, like heads or tails. Heads, you get an attack boost icon, and tails, you get a skull icon. And the skull icon, I'll get into all that stuff in a bit. But as you equip a sword or armor or an accessory or bauble, you may get additional die faces. And that coin, depending on the dice faces that you acquire, can become a 4-sided die or an 8-sided die or a 10-sided die. And it gets to be, you can get a pretty decent die roster based on your equipment. And the different size of the die can be things like movement enhancement or attack enhancement or the aforementioned skull, which is like a detriment. At the beginning of every battle turn, both the party members' dice and the monsters, who also get dice, all get rolled at the same time in one big pool. And then one at a time, dependent on the order of who goes first and when, which is completely randomized by the game, mind you, so there's no speed stat here, you determine which bonus you want to take. One, then the other, then the other, then the other. So you're probably thinking, oh, that's not so bad. But that can get a little risky because, again, you draw a die, and then the opponent draws a die. And if you see a thing that's out there that you really want, like a double attack bonus, you might not want to hold off on selecting that because the enemy can take your bonus before you can get it, and then you're stuck with the trash. So it's not a game breaker, but it can really turn the tide of the game depending on how it goes, because some of these die phases can activate your super attacks or special moves and things of that nature. Actual dungeon combat, though, aside from the die rolling, is fairly traditional, though with a little bit of a twist. So when you think of a typical turn-based spider, you're thinking things like HP and MP, right? Like magic points, you need this many MP to cast a spell. This game does not have MP either. What it does have is just whatever attacks you get based on what equipment you're wearing. So if you have a sword that does, you know, does two damage in a lance formation, that means that you'll attack out two squares and you'll do two damage. If the enemy has armor on, you have to pierce through the armor first before you can start doing damage to the actual character. So that might require you to hammer on them double time to get it down. The game is designed by doing this, the game allows you to do some pretty awesome stuff. Like, but one of your first attacks in the game is a 3x3 damage attack radius. So it's like you're hitting up to 9 guys at once for decent damage. But the counterbalance to that is, generally on maps, especially later in the game, you're outnumbered heavily, and you want to best put these things to use in order to kind of blow through the enemy masses and destroy whatever monster spawning points are on the map to wrap things up too sweet, because you can get easily outnumbered and overrun. Let me think here. So aside from equipping items, you also have to equip the pack in which you carry items in, for like healing and the like. So you might want to carry a diet soda to heal hit points, because that's apparently what you heal with in this world is diet soda. But in order to carry items in the battle, you have to put the backpack on first, and then you put the backpack might have like 2 slots or 3 slots, and each slot can correspond to one type of item. So you might want to put diet soda in one slot and then lettuce into another, which allows you to get like a different, if you eat a piece of lettuce, you'll get an armor bump of 1, stuff like that. So you have to kind of select your items before each mission, based both the quantity that you can carry and the specific items you're going to carry, and equip those as well. The game is a lot of fun. I do enjoy it. The problems I did have with it, though, don't ruin the game, but they are kind of irksome. And the one that I'm still struggling with is kind of like the interface. So, for example, if you're on the map and you want to move a unit on, say, 4 spaces, but you're trying to gauge you're trying to figure out where they can go in order to put them in range of attacking a monster. But you screw up and you accidentally put the guy on the ground. You can't take that move back. Once you've locked them on the ground, you can't say, crap, I didn't want to stay here. Let me retrace my steps and move them again. The game will already say, no, you can't do that. So you're officially committed to where you put them and then you have to attack. Or not, but you're not moving again. So it's not a game breaker, but it does not really pay to willy-nilly move your guys around. You can kind of click on the guy and kind of make him hover around a bit and see where blocks end up, but you don't want to accidentally set him down. Otherwise, you can't retake the move, which is a frustrating thing. The other thing is that when you're in the main hub trying to select between picking a mission or moving to equip a guy or upgrade to put stuff in your item bag, sometimes it's hard to outright tell when you're at the right place to move the icon around. So like, for example, on the map, you hit A to select the location, then A to select the mission you want to do. But if you want to back out, you have to hit like three times, but it's hard to even tell sometimes if the icon is indicating that you're moving from around the map, or if you're moving around between map and character and bar selection. You're probably like, what the hell are you talking about? But in a nutshell, sometimes it's hard to tell where you are on the selection interface at mission prep. But the art style of the game is really nice. I like the humor and the writing. The story itself isn't anything to write home about, but I like the character dialogue, and I enjoy seeing the characters interact with each other. The music isn't anything special, but it's good enough to get the game moving. And the gameplay itself is fun enough that I honestly kind of don't care about the things that I don't like. I just enjoy playing the game as a whole, because this does something really awesome, which is like it's one more game that is not just a straight up carbon copy of the tabletop experience.
No.
But it's influenced by the tabletop experience, and it's done well enough that, one, even if I owned the other game, I'd still want this. But to not have the other game I still feel like I'm getting a good experience by buying this instead.
Well, then overall, $20 on it. What do you think?
I think it's worth the money. I definitely think it's worth the money, especially if you're into tactics or RPGs. I know a lot of people have been lately clamoring. Like, I saw a friend the other day, you know, when Nintendo announced all those Switch games, Square announced all those Final Fantasy games coming to the Switch. And he was like,
and Xbox.
Friend was like, give us Final Fantasy Tactics. And I said, why? The game was great, but here's like four other games you can play that are not the same game you've played already that feel like it. So it's a new experience, but it taps those good notes, if that makes sense. Like, why wait for a game you played 15 or 20 years ago when these cool games are here right now? This is one such example of that. If someone's like, I want Final Fantasy, like, why don't you play Super Dungeon Tactics? It's a good game. It's new. You're not supporting a company's old work. You're supporting a company's new work. And yeah, that's a good thing. Great game, though. I recommend it.
Awesome. Good stuff.
Yes, I try.
Pernell, it is always a blast having you on. Do you have any final thoughts to wrap it up?
No, honestly, I've talked so much today. I might wrap it up with a pillow and a hot toddy. That's where I'm at right now. I'm good, though.
All right, next game to talk about is called Blast Zone Tournament, developed and published by Victory Lap Games. It released July 31st on Steam Early Access for $19.99. Fun eSport, that's the bomb. Ha ha ha. 32-player online battle royale, 500 maps, 240-level single-player campaign, over 10 billion customization options. Play now. Playing this one for us, Ian Griffin, how are you doing?
Hey, I'm not doing too bad. What's happening for a second?
Just, you know... doing the show.
Yeah, no, I hear you, man.
That's cool. That's my life. How's Blast Zone?
I found it to be rather enjoyable. I mean, it, you know, I kind of went into it somewhat cold turkey, you know, aside from just reading the blurb on thing on Steam, and it basically kind of looked like a Bomberman clone, and for all intents and purposes, I mean, it basically is. I mean, I don't necessarily mean that in a bad way, but if you're big on Bomberman, you now have a very, very, very comparable version of it on PC. And, you know, and I kind of feel bad about, you know, doing the whole Simpsons did it sort of thing, constantly comparing it to Bomberman, but it basically has, like, everything that Bomberman has. I mean, it has, like you said, like, billions of customizations, and there are a metric buttload of different customizations for your character, and usually, you know, and it has a pretty solid I want to say free to play model, because I think there is like a currency thing in there, but there's no paywalls. It's all purely aesthetic stuff, so, you know, by not paying anything, you don't get screwed out of any kind of content, you don't get, you know, any disadvantages. It's all purely aesthetic. And, you know, even then, with enough time playing and grinding or whatever, I mean, you can eventually get a ton of stuff. I mean, it's not that big of a deal. But as far as the gameplay itself, I mean, it's you know, it's just like Bomberman. You've got an arena, you've get, you know, your bombs, you get all of your, you know, your typical standard power-ups, you get like a lot of the similar game modes, and they don't have a lot of the more wacky, zanier type items that you'd find in Bomberman, but but it's not to say that they won't add it in later. But you know, also that you can tell that they're trying to keep things somewhat streamlined and optimized for like actual competitive play, because you mentioned, you know, esport in there, and this does seem to have the potential and the setup to try to be a somewhat serious, air quotes, serious, you know, competitive style of Bomberman. Because that's the thing. Because sometimes in Bomberman, like, depending on the game mode, it's basically a clusterfuck shitstorm, and whoever wins, it's pure luck. You know, I mean, it's sort of like the Battle Royale, like the 32-player just free-for-all.
Which is insane for a Bomberman-style game. Yeah. 32 people all at once.
Yeah, and it's almost a little nerve-wracking, because, you know, ready, 3, 2, 1, go. You literally spend that entire time trying to find your character. despite the fact that there's a giant colored arrow over your head, it still takes you those 5 seconds. It's like, where am I? Where am I? Where am I? There I am. Oh, shit. Where are the bombs? Because it's, like, you know, like a, just imagine a giant arena, and there's different variations of how it's set up too, but like sometimes there's like a giant arena and literally everyone is just lined up on the outer perimeter. Go.
Good Lord.
And I've yet to actually beat one, but you know, like I said,
you got whoever close. Does,
yeah. I got close a couple of times.
Cause I saw you stream it a few times and you were doing pretty good. You were getting into the final few.
Yeah. And like the only like strategy like you can really do is like don't even be proactive about trying to kill people. Just focus on avoiding everything. And I find that that's usually how I kind of last the longest. So sometimes it doesn't matter because someone will get like, you know, like a max range bomb power up and you get literally nuked from the other side of the level. And it's like, how'd I die? You know, and then sudden death immediately starts like about 10 seconds in, and the arena, you know, for anyone that's playing Bomberman, basically the arena starts getting filled in with impenetrable blocks, and if you happen to get caught under one, you instantly die and lose. But it has like, you know, it has like all the classic game modes that you might be familiar with from Bomberman. There's like the zombie mode, so if you die, you turn into a zombie, you move at half speed, but you can fuck up the other players still playing legitly. I mean, you can't drop bombs, but you can get in the way and you can be annoying and, you know, just piss in the Kool-Aid to your heart's content. And it's still entirely possible to win, you know, because there was one match I played. I was the first one to get blasted. I was a zombie and I just made sure I was in the right place at the right time and I doinked up most of the other players. And when it came down to it, I ended up winning.
Nice.
So, you know, just because it seems like you might lose, you might not. And let's see, the zombie mode. There's like team battles, you know. I'm trying to think how many players, because I think I've seen 4v4 and I want to see say 8v8,
which is again pretty big for a Bomberman style game.
Yeah. And one of the beautiful things about it is that it is very nicely Twitch integrated. So there is like a menu you can jump into and directly invite your friends straight off Steam if they own it. There's even like options to pick a Steam group to represent. And you know, of course there's like different variations of scoreboards. Like you can match your stats versus your buddies. You can match your stats versus global, regional, that kind of thing. So, you know, there's a lot of statistics and everything like that. And you know, I mean, like I said, I mean, you could definitely tell that they're paving the way to make this a potentially competitive game. And, you know, just a fun fuck around for, you know, just for the crazy insanity lols.
Yeah. Which is always good.
Mm-hmm. And there's even a single player campaign. And for the most part, I really like how it was set up. Like if you've never touched a Bomberman game before, and actually there was a person in my stream the other night, cause I kind of played it again just to refresh myself because there had been a couple updates.
Yeah. It looks like they update it pretty frequently, which is good.
Yeah. Yep. They've been pretty on the ball. So the devs are pretty proactive about, you know, working on it, tweaking it, you know, like right now it's more like we're just like, they haven't added like a lot of content, but it's more along the lines of, we just want to make sure everything's running smoothly. If there's any bugs, if there's any, you know, kinks to work out, you know, it's kind of that phase. Cause I mean, it's still early access, but, yeah, I mean, they have a really great foundation to work with. You know, when they do start adding content, I'm pretty sure it's going to be pretty solid, but like the single player, if you've never played a Bomberman game before, like this does a really great job of teaching you exactly what to do. It's like, hey, this is a bomb, put it down. This is what it does. This is what blows up. This is what doesn't. Okay. Now blow this up and there you go. Next level is, well, take what you just learned and figure out how to get out of here. Okay. And then, you know, the next one is like, this is one of the abilities you can use. This is how it works. Now do it. Cool. Next level, figure out how to use that ability to get out of here. And so on and so forth until you basically have a really good comprehensive understanding of the game. And then they throw you in a like 18-man free for all with only one life.
Oh God.
It's like, okay, now that you've learned pretty much all the basics of the game and you can use them fairly well to maneuver your way around, here is a 1v14 or 1v15. You have one life, have fun. See you on the other side.
Good luck.
Like, yep, we kind of held your hand through the shallow and the not quite so shallow deep end, or, you know, so we're just going to toss you off into the ocean. Have fun. But the single player campaign is more like not necessarily try to beat all these guys, but like really interesting puzzles that you kind of have to figure out and try to think outside the box. And through doing that, I mean, you'll kind of inherently get better at like PvP because, you know, you'll be kind of thrust into situations that, you know, sometimes you have to really think about it.
Yeah.
And you'll get used to how the bombs work, the timing, best ways to hide, best ways to avoid, you know, different patterns that you can drop bombs in, you know, just overall working on your strat. But, it is a very, very good game.
Nice. So for $20 on this one, what do you think of it?
For $20, I would definitely say try it. I mean, I'm kind of a cheap ass when it comes to games. Like if it was definitely on sale for less than $20, like definitely buy it. Just definitely fucking buy it. Like if you're a Bomberman fan, definitely buy it. If you're a hardcore Bomberman fan and you've been looking for something to jam on the PC, that would definitely be a buy it. I mean, the only reason I would say to wait is a try it. Honestly, like, I don't really see any major flaws with this game.
Nice.
Like, some of the menu navigation could be a little streamlined, but, like, just, you know, it's very little quality of life things that could be easily rectified at any point down the road. But I think this game shows a lot of potential, so, I'll just say buy it. Because the only issue I've had, quote-unquote issue I've had with this game is that there aren't enough human players. I mean, I've been playing against AI, which, in a manner of speaking, is cool because it's good to know that if you don't have enough human players for a full match, they'll toss in some AI guys that aren't completely stupid to at least facilitate the match. But yeah, I mean, get some more players. Like, I would love to see what a lot of this stuff would be like with human majority players.
32 real live players.
Yeah.
Oh God, like, that would be insanity.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, you really can't get mad. It's more like, man, it's more like, how long can you survive? Like, oh shit, it's like, wow, I'm amazed I made it this long. It's like, yay, I broke top 15. Okay, cool. I'm happy with that. I wasn't one of the bitches that went out in the first go.
I didn't get crushed by the first round of falling blocks either.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, man. Well, Ian, it is always good having you on chatting about this kind of stuff. Do you have any final thoughts on it?
Skadoosh.
All right, final game to talk about tonight is called V-Rally 4, developed by Kyloton Games, published by Big Ben Interactive and Maximum Games. It released September 11th on Xbox One, PS4, and Switch for $59.99. Coming out on the 25th on PC, the return of a legendary off-road racing game. Enjoy an extreme experience while becoming an expert in demanding simulation. Take on the challenges of rallies, rallycross, drifts, buggies, and hill climbs, and set off on a spectacular journey across every continent. Checking this one out, Jacob Garner. Jacob, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. How about you?
Oh, I'm just doing the show again. Oh. Still.
Still?
Yeah.
What is this, episode 415?
Yeah, I think so.
Huh.
We're inching up there to 420. I'm legit excited for that one.
An episode that, you know, it's just us giggling and occasionally munching on food. We don't even talk about video games.
Probably. Just,
I'd be really good at climbing ladders. Oh, yeah, really, Joe.
That's really cool, man. Oh.
Want to play Rocket League? I can't find my hands.
I want to know what kind of ladder, man. Anyway, V-Rally, we should probably talk about that.
Probably. So, it's a race... What? Oh, what?
Huh?
I don't know. All right.
I was going to ask, how is it?
Oh, I thought it was pretty good. I didn't enjoy it as much. Like, it was challenging, but I didn't find it as much of a challenge as, like, F1 2018. But I definitely did have to, like, change up my driving style with this one. with this one, it's rally, like, or Baja, whatever you want to call it, that kind of racing. So some of it's on a track, some of it's on dirt, like some of it's in like forest areas, like, but it's like mostly like dirt and mud racing. And you have to go around these tracks, and then there's this other thing called like a Joker lap, which is like you take like a slightly alternate route, but you have to do it once. Otherwise, like, you lose time. Like, I don't know. I thought that was kind of weird. I'm guessing that's a real thing.
I've seen it on the X Games.
Oh, okay. I haven't, like, the only time I ever used to watch the X Games was, like, for the skateboarding and snowboarding stuff when I was a kid.
I still watch it.
Oh, I like it. Cool. Yeah, no, it's good entertainment. I haven't had cable for 5 years, so.
Oh, yeah, that'll do it.
Yeah, kinda. So, anyway, about V-Rally.
Yes, so, tell me more about the game. What do you do in the game?
So, you drive around, on the track, and of course you're trying to beat, the AI who... I don't know. There were times I felt like they were pretty bullshit. Like, there were races where I definitely had a lead, and then all of a sudden I'm getting close to the finish line and everybody was up my butthole. But other times it felt fair. It was totally understood, understandable why I lost, or why I placed third or something like that. And then there's of course the standard career mode stuff, which much like F1 2018, there was there's a lot of customization options with it. So, if you know a lot about this kind of stuff, I'm sure somebody more well versed in this kind of stuff will obviously know what all the stuff meant and how it's going to help your car. For me, it was a tad overwhelming. You were already familiar with, the sport. I'm assuming that you were more, did you get to play this?
I put a little bit of time into it. I had a tough time with the handling in the game. I felt it was a bit too twitchy for me.
Yeah. Honestly, early on, that was definitely a big problem for me. But, my other big problem with it was that, did you do career mode at all?
Yeah, just a little bit.
Okay. When you got your car, it gives you the option of do you want to do a test drive? And it's oh, sweet. Okay. This car handles great. And then when I in the test thing, it felt great. And then when I took it out for a race, it felt like shit. It didn't handle nearly as well as, the one that I drove. So I don't know if it's when you're testing it, it's this is what it's like when you're done upgrading it. And then when you butt, I don't know. So maybe that's what it's like. I didn't get that far along. I hired my mechanics and I was making upgrades here and there and stuff like that. But I don't know. The ride never felt as smooth as it did during the test thing. And while I had fun, I had fun playing it, doing the races and stuff like that. There were a couple of races that I did finish first in. I had to knock the AI all the way down to zero, but I did it.
Proud
of you. Thank you very much. a lot of the times I was somewhere in the middle. There were a couple of races that I, in my opinion, are complete bullshit that I should have done a hell of a lot better. That the AI just it seemingly just snuck up on me. But my biggest thing is that I actually had more fun doing the test drive areas and looking around and seeing what the developers hid in the test drive areas than I had with in one of the tracks, there's actually a little bowling, it's kind of a bowling lane. So really? You can actually I don't want to say it's off the map, but it's there. It's a little hidden. You actually have to go off the road and you have to go find it. But there's a little bowling lane. And at the end of it, there's these pillars that are set up like pins and you can knock them all over and stuff like that. There was a different track that had a huge fuck off ramp. And, if you hit it at the right speed, you automatically get an achievement because there's an achievement for getting, 40 feet of air in one jump. So, and honestly, I just kept hitting that ramp back and forth cause that was a ton of fun. and then, there's another track that has I don't want to call it an RC car thing, but it was almost a slot car track. That thing actually wasn't hidden. All you had to do is just go down the airstrip and boom, it's right there to the right. But it's just it was those fun little touches that the developers put into the game that I actually had more fun, dicking around on the test areas than I did trying to actually win stuff and be the best rally driver ever. my other complaint with the rally driving thing was that it's just like, if you bought a certain kind of car, then you can only enter in certain kind of races. And so, like, you know, I bought this car that I, in my opinion, it handled the best. It was best suited to my style. And it automatically shut me out of a bunch of races.
Yeah, because certain cars could only do certain disciplines, which makes sense right. in a realistic way. But, you know, this is supposed to be more sim than arcade, obviously.
Right. And it's like, I get it. But at the same time, like, that wasn't like, I was like, come on, guys. Come, like,
just let me.
And race. Then, right. And then on top of it, when you're doing your career mode and stuff like that, you have to pay your mechanics, which is understandable. You have to pay for the damage to your car. Again, understandable. But it's just like, if you don't start getting better, which I was, you know, I was having issues with because I was mostly placing between third and sixth every race. And granted, thankfully, like, you still get like some money even if you play sixth. But it's just like, if you don't start doing better, you're not, like, your career mode's going to end pretty quickly. So, I don't know. Even on the easiest thing, I was still struggling with it. But I had fun with it. I mean, it looks nice. It sounds great.
Oh, it looks gorgeous on the X as well. Like, it is stunning.
Well, you also have to remember, I have, like, a, you know, not as nice TV. But, yeah, I'm sure it looks great in, like,
that's why
4K.
I'm chiming in to mention that it looks fantastic on the X. I'm chiming in here. I'm adding to the conversation, you son of a bitch.
That's what you sound like.
It is.
Anyway, my only other thing is that, like, if there's music in the game, I only heard one track. And granted, it wasn't a bad track, but it was like the same rap song over and over again. So I don't know if that was a glitch or what. But yeah, I mean, I thought it was fun. I enjoyed it.
Well, overall then, for $60, what do you think of it?
I wouldn't go for 60. Somewhere between 30 and 40, I'd be more comfortable with. So, I mean, like, if it's on sale, most definitely pick it up. I mean, I enjoyed it. Don't get me wrong. But 60, I think 60, I felt was a tad steep.
Yeah.
But I liked it.
Do agree. I think people who are into the V Rally series and into rally racing are going to really enjoy the game. I will say that it had the unfortunate timing of being available to us right when the Forza Horizon 4 demo came out. And that's just strictly unfair for any other racing game right now. to go that's up against true. Forza. So I think that's part of why I had such struggles with the controls in the game and felt that they were just way too tight, is because Forza, it felt flawless with the controls. And I was just struggling with V Rally. It kind of feels like it was designed for a PS4 controller that has tighter analog sticks than the Xbox One does.
Okay, that's a fair assessment.
Which I wouldn't be shocked if PS4 was the lead platform, because that's just how it is.
Right. Huh. That would be interesting to check out.
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, that is it for this episode. Jacob, thanks for coming on and chatting and doing all this other happy horse shit.
Of course. Glad I could do it for you.
You have any final words to end the show, or any final discussion that you want to tackle here at the very end where no one's listening?
I caught a Porygon today.
Oh, Pokemon Go?
Yeah, I was super excited. I was at Cheats, and I was standing in line, like, waiting for the cashier, because there was, like, three people ahead of me, and I was like, holy shit! And then, like, everyone turned around, and I'm like, it's on my phone thing. And then, like, they turned around and, like, went back to, like, the cashiering and stuff, and yeah. But I was really excited.
Jesus Christ, you are a fucking nerd.
Dude! Whatever. I was really excited. Plus, I caught, like, one of the legendary dogs yesterday, so that was pretty cool, too.
Well, then who let the dogs out?
I'm not going to play along with this.
We'll be right back.